To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction. All right, you've heard the song, so you know what you're listening to. So this, my name is Don, and you are?
I am Al.
Okay.
Who's technically challenged? We're technically challenged. We've been trying to do this for about an hour and a half.
You know, I know this show is not known for the incredible sound quality, like many other podcasts are really smooth. But the first, I want to say the first year, every time we got together, somebody tried to bring in a different kind of microphone. I don't know why, but they plug it in. We'd spend an hour just trying to be able to record. Anyway, now Al and I are going through the internet, the beauty of the internet, to record a show while we're in different places. And yeah, we spent an hour. I thought, this is going to be a really good podcast, because we're going to start, you're listening to Two Dimension!
Finally, I went on Google Chrome, and I guess that's the secret, I don't know. Mm. But hey, we're trying, you know, we're doing this long distance, so, you know. It is what it is, and it's free. Fun. Free to be, you and me.
Fun times.
Yeah. So I have not read a comic book in like ages. I haven't been to a comic shop in a couple of months. I haven't had a car for 3 weeks. So you know how that is.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, dude. That's really unpleasant. But you did.
Yeah.
Say
the old Sonata just kicked the bucket. So I've been having a lot of weird experiences on Craigslist and other classified sites trying to get a car. People that tell me that post their car for sale, and then when you try to contact them, they don't respond. And then when you go to their house, they say, no, it's not for sale anymore. And I'm like, oh, so why is it still on the classified? Duh, you know. So anyway, that's what's been going on lately. But I believe you've been reading comics.
I have been.
And buying comics.
But you did say that you're surrounded by comics.
So what have you been reading lately?
Well, it's funny you mentioned. I was wanting to talk about this. I added it to the reading list. But the 10-Cent Plague.
Oh, yeah, that book. Yeah, we were talking about that.
It's by David Hajdu. I think it's how I say his name. I apologize if I'm wrong. But it says, The Great Comic Book Scare and How It Changed America. I've always heard about this. I added them to the reading list, books I read. I found this one. This one, a lot of them start talking about the history of comics. This one basically is talking about how comics started with basically Action One. There was comics around and how Gaines started, you know, the whole story you talk about, how he kind of invented this American comic book, which it depends on who you talk to. Some people say that's true. Some people say it's not. But anyway, he was involved. And always, people kind of overlook Will Eisner. You know, the work he was doing with Victor Fox. And comics were a hot thing. Everybody's trying to get in on the comic book thing. As you read this, they started talking with somebody that I was not aware of. But you talked about. And that's Biro. Was it Charles Biro?
Yeah, crime does not pay.
Yeah, crime does not pay. Crime comics are something I wasn't aware of. And it was when I was reading about Frank Miller, when he got famous for doing Daredevil. It was after The Dark Knight, and he was doing Sin City, which was a crime comic. But he was talking about, he wasn't interested in what, you know, everything was superheroes when I was growing up. And he said what he was interested in was crime comics, but the only avenue he had was superhero comics. So he did Daredevil, but he says, I'm going to do them as a crime comic. And by this time, I guess there still was a comics code, but it was kind of lame. And they slowly started building a thing up, but it was the crime comics. And again, according to this book, Charles Biro's Crime Does Not Pay had a lot to do with that. But could you tell us a little bit about the Charles Barrow books? Did you ever read them?
I've seen reprints. Yeah, they were... I remember George Tuska did a lot of work for him. And I never really got into them that much. But, yeah, I seem to remember they... Well, the EC did put out one of their books. It was called Crime Suspense Stories. So I guess that's just an offshoot of the crime comics. And I guess they were like pulps, like the Mickey Spillane, Mike Hammer, maybe even Raymond Chandler stuff, but a little more violent. I seem to remember, like, some rough covers from some old crime books. Maybe not Crime Does Not Pay, but some other ones. But it was definitely, like, I think Biro or Biro, Biro, I think, was an artist, too. He drew a lot of them. And, I mean, the art was okay. It wasn't as, like, exciting as EC Comics, but it was all right, you know. And I didn't realize that that was the beginning of the 10-cent plague or whatever. I thought it was like EC Comics, actually. I guess they were the icing on the cake, maybe. I don't know.
I think what you said was it, because I was always understood it was EC that did it. And, of course, they also bring up that one comic that Jack Cole did, you know, the guy shooting his eyeball with a hypodermic needle.
Oh, the injury to eye covers. Yeah, those were rough, yeah.
And I don't know who published those, but they always show the drawing of it and said it was Jack Cole. But, again, when I think of Jack Cole, I think of Plastic Man, thinking, how in the world would that, you know, but when I see the
drawing. You know that Jack Cole is also well-known to a lot of people for Playboy magazine.
Yes.
He did a lot of really beautiful cartoons for Playboy for many years, probably till the end of his life. And I never remember seeing those until I saw like reprints of them like 15, 20 years ago. And I go, oh, that's Jack Cole. Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. That doesn't look anything like Plastic Man or, you know, or he worked for Eisner too. He did The Spirit for a while too.
Yeah. He got around and he was really versatile creator. He wasn't just an artist, but didn't he write stories too?
Yeah, he wrote stuff. I don't know what, but he did write stories, you know. But the only guy that I remember from the, you know, from that era that was the sexy comic guy, even though I didn't like some of his art, was the guy who did all those goofy, oh no, I'm having a boomer moment, I forgot his name, Bill Ward. Oh, not to be confused with Bill Ward, drummer for Black Sabbath, but but Bill Ward was the guy who did all those, you know, kind of cheesy, sexy books. But he was actually another Golden Age comic book artist who had a more, whatever you want to call it, civilian style. He looked like, it wasn't exaggerated or cartoony, and he was actually really good, but he made all his money from the sexy books. But I didn't realize that Jack Cole was well known for that. So and I forgot that he was the guy who drew the injury to eye cover. There was another cover that I think was reprinted in one of those haunted horror books where it had like a monkey with his head, you know, pulling monkey brains out of his head. You know, they were rough books back then. That they I got a feeling kids were the only ones that were reading them.
No, you know? No. Well, you know, you were talking about some of those Mickey Spillane and the Mike Hammer books and stuff like that. That is something I read about in Men of Tomorrow, another book on our reading list. But that one, they were paperback books is what they started doing. Signet was one, Fawcett was one. But they were putting out these crime mystery hard-boiled books. And, you know, people were eating them up. Before, they were always pulps, which I guess were kind of trashy and looked down on. But they started making a lot of money. And they were doing quite well. I know when DC sued Fawcett over Captain Marvel, and it finally went through and they had to stop, Fawcett decided not to mess with it anymore. So comic books were starting to turn into more trouble than they're worth. And they were doing quite well with the paperbacks. So they just dropped their comics altogether and just switched to paperbacks, which, you know, they continued with. I had a teacher, this is in 1972, in middle school, and she was talking about paperback books when she was a kid going to school. You weren't allowed to bring a paperback book into school. She said they weren't good. They were looked down upon. And she said they were trashy. And she was kind of making a comment about now the school sells them. And, you know, school has book fairs. You know, paperback books are different. And I do remember they were that TV show to tell the truth. Bill Cullen, one of the, you know, panelists on it, when they talk about what he was doing, he says, well, they're working on putting the Betty Crocker cookbook into paperback for the first time. But paperback, when I was growing up, was a big thing. And but I guess before, when I read this, I kind of understand what they're coming from. They were basically crime books that, you know, cheap books that people read that were kind of trashy and risque. You know, and after a while, they just started publishing everything under it because, you know, paperback's cheaper than hardback books. But according to this, they told the whole story about Charles Biro, as you said. I like that better. But they were telling his, I never heard of that. And then they start talking about EC Comics and about, you know, the story we always hear about how Bill Gaines, he was a chemistry, he was going to school to become a chemistry teacher for high school. And his mom basically forced him to take over his father's comic company that was fledgling because the family had everything tied into it. And he went kicking and screaming. He had no interest in it. He didn't like doing it. And his father was trying to do kids' comics. You know, it's, you know, they had all these kids' comics that basically he didn't even like kids. It was just a money-making thing. And they said it's basically the comics kind of tasted like castor oil for kids. It was supposed to be for kids, but it wouldn't be something the kids liked. And then basically he hired Al Feldstein because Al Feldstein did some teen books for another company. So he brought him over, and then teen books were kind of falling by the wayside. They weren't selling. Everybody was dropping their teen books. And that's when they started trying crime books and horror books. And Al Feldstein was the one behind it. I never knew that. And it just escalated from there. I've always heard people talk about the 10-cent plague. One thing in the book that kind of throws me was I always thought it was a national thing. You know, the federal government got into it. But basically it was just local neighborhoods where, you know, this one kid, he was a good student. He worked at the drugstore as a soda jerk. And he was getting upset seeing kids come over and read the crime comics. And he was the one that started that whole burning thing in his area. And they were basically shaming kids if they ever read anything they didn't approve of. And then after that, the teachers and stuff in other schools and other communities started standing up against them. And it just kind of rotated from there. But it wasn't a national thing. It was local stuff that just kept building and building. And finally, the federal government had to step in towards the end of it and said, look. And that's when the Wortham hearings all started. Thoughts?
Yeah, I always wondered, and I probably know the answer, but I can't remember. Maybe you do. They wouldn't have had this problem if superhero books would have still been being published, because the superhero books were, for the most part, clean and, you know, I always wondered why they turned to the darker, grittier subject matter. Does it talk about it in the book at all?
Some, but, you know, like they brought up Wonder Woman. You know, Wonder Woman was, even though it was still being published, you know, she was always getting tied up and chained and everything else. And there was talk about that was like S&M fetishism. And, what was that guy, Charles Moulton? To him, what he was trying to show was she was breaking free of it. Like, they kept trying to tie her down and she could break free. But, you know, personal interest and all the other stuff he's getting involved in. I mean, basically, when people talk about Wonder Woman before, she's always, it was bondage. And DC even had a woman working for him, and her sole job was to write him letters saying, you got to calm this down. You can't do this. You're going too far. But I don't think that was actually his intent. I think he was trying to show that she was persevering through all this stuff that they were, you know, tying her down with. You know, the whole thing, they always brought up Batman and Robin. You know, why is this young boy living with a single man? You know, and he was always saying they had to be gay. I never thought Batman and Robin were gay, you know, when I was a kid. I see parodies of it now, but even now when I read those stories, I basically, I was looked at it, his luckiest kid in the world was like hanging out with the most awesome uncle in the world fighting crime, you know? I mean, that's just how I always looked at it. So, that's a good point you brought up, because in the book they're talking about some schools and some of them, they were dividing the comics up. They were saying, like, some of the superhero comics were okay, they were safe. The crime comics are the ones they were really going after. And one school, a lot of these kids were talking about, and when it was all over, and towards the end was going on, they started realizing that they were being used by, you know, the principal or by people, you know, wanting to get rid of comics, but they didn't really feel that way, but they're getting them up, you know, excited. But they're talking about some of these places had piles, you know, different groups you put the comics. The crime comics went to one pile. The other comics went to one pile. You know, the funny animal comics and, you know, children's comics were kind of in a safe pile. Those were okay to read. The Jungle Women comics that you and I talk about a lot, those were going under an empty, under a loose stare. A loose stare, they were hiding them in some unused closet. The boys were hiding those to read them by themselves later.
Yeah, like the Phantom Lady and stuff like that. I guess the artists were having a little bit of fun and drawing stuff a little sexier and getting away with it. And I imagine, too, what happened was when superhero books started dying out a little bit after the war, because the whole thing that caused the superhero books to become so big was they were all fighting against Hitler. They were all fighting the war. They were all patriotic. And when the war was over, I guess, you know, people said, well, the books are dying out. Let's try something new. And I'm pretty sure that around that time, a lot of film noir movies were being made, you know, like the Raymond Chandler or the Sam Spade or whatever. So maybe somebody said, Bureau said, hey, you know, I got an idea. I'll do a crime comic. And then all of a sudden it hit. You know, it's like everything else. Just throw it at the wall and see what sticks. That's my guess anyway. I'd have to look into it because I'm really not well read on the crime comics history or anything like that. There are books on it, but I really don't know much about it, you know?
Yeah, well, it didn't go away. It wasn't comics anymore. It was the hard-boiled fiction stories, which, you know, became mainstream. You know, especially in the 80s, they always talked about that and referred back to it. But that's what it went from comics to just regular prose, and, you know, they make movies and stuff. Comic books got huge during World War II, but one reason why was, again, is where we say cheap entertainment. You know, they sold it in the PXs and all the camps. You know, you had American soldiers all over the world. They could send the comics, they could keep them in their backpacks. It was cheap entertainment, it was fun entertainment, it was something to leave boredom, they could pass them around. But basically, when they all came back home, they'd already seen enough adventure to last a lifetime. They'd seen enough horrific things. Everybody just wanted to go back to normal life. And, you know, by this time, television was coming out as well. That was another thing that hit the nail in the coffin. But the comics were big, but during World War II, they just went through the ceiling. And then after World War II, they went right back down. And then, you know, like I said, they were doing horror books, they were doing crime books. I always heard the horror books are the ones they were going after. Crime books are something I wasn't really aware of till, again, I read about Frank Miller talking about he liked crime books. And Charles Bureau, I'd never heard of. Crime Does Not Pay, I wasn't familiar. I realized I'd seen some covers after I looked it up. But that was a whole genre in comics that I was completely, it vanished.
Yeah, I seem to remember like DC having some books from the 50s even called Gangbusters, but illustrated by Ruben Moreira. And what else was there? There was a lot of them. I guess it was like, I mean, if you look at pictures from back in the day, you see the comic book racks. It's pretty amazing how much variety there was. And the books were bigger back then. They were made bigger, you know, so it was a real, I mean, every once in a while, you know, when I post an old Golden Age book, it's like in the 40s, maybe early 50s, probably late 40s, you're getting like 64 pages for a dime. Yeah, that's a lot of entertainment for a kid. That'll take you like, you know, an hour or more to read or whatever. So yeah, it was definitely like a and another alternative to the movie. The movies are only on, I guess, on the weekends maybe or at nights, and radio was on, and you know, comics was the other, was the visual medium that filled the gap. But yeah, you know, but around the same time with the crime comics, there was always Western comics. Yeah. And then romance comics showed up, and then, you know, the superheroes came back. There was always one form or the other. And I guess Frank Miller's, you know, ode to crime comics was Sin City. You know, that would have been his noir, you know, masterpiece or whatever you want to call it. You know, didn't care for the movie that much, but... you know, the book was interesting. It was good. You know, it was like over the top, but it was all right. It was definitely like his Mickey Spillane, tribute.
Yeah, Mickey Spillane was, he was in all those light beer commercials in the 80s with all the washed up sports guys.
he used to be on, well, Mickey Spillane wrote comic books. He worked for Atlas, I believe. That's he wrote right. comic books and he wrote... I think he also wrote some of those one-page stories they would have in the comic books. In order to get the postage right, they had to have X amount of words, so they would have a text story in the book. And Miss Spillane worked for Stan Lee and maybe others too. I don't know. So he was around back then, doing all sorts of stuff.
Well, they did talk about that. I don't know if it was Men of Tomorrow or if it was 10-Cent Plague, but they did talk about Mickey Spillane worked and did comics, and of course he went on and started doing prose and got huge. I just remember those light beer commercials. They always had Bob Uecker and a bunch of, you know, old sports guys, and they all
Alex Karras.
Yeah, and they all on the commercials. They all seemed like kind of lovable dullards, but Mickey Spillane was in it, and he always had women. You know, they're always like Betty Boop kind of women. But here in town, they were talking about one of the DJs said something about Mickey Spillane. You know, he's the only guy in those light beer commercials that can get a date.
Let me tell you something. On some of his paperbacks in the 50s, they had the most beautiful covers by some of the greatest illustrators of all time. I mean, I don't know if he illustrated many Spillanes. I think he did Brett Halliday covers, but Robert McGinnis, one of my favorite artists of all time, man, there was some beautiful art on those. And those books were pretty raunchy and pretty violent too. I mean, you know, they were probably worse than the comic books in a lot of ways, you know, so the comic books were kind of like, you know, pikers compared to that. Have you ever seen any of the Mike Hammer movies that they made in the 50s and 60s?
No.
Oh my God, they're really weird and cool. I mean, there's one that I watched on TCM a couple of years ago, Kiss Me Deadly. Oh man, it is an amazingly dark, gritty movie, and it ends in an atomic bomb. I'm not kidding you, man. It's like out there, you know what I mean? It's like, whoa. You know, it's like it's basically like he's tracking down a briefcase, and it's like at the end, there's this woman. I forgot the plot line, but anyway, at the end of the woman wants to know what's in the briefcase because there's a shootout or something, and she opens it and it starts glowing, and it kind of glows like in Pulp Fiction, and it ends in like nukes. It's like, oh my God, this is a strange movie. It ends with Mike Hammer and his Velda, whatever her name is, or somebody or some other woman walking towards the beach as the beach house where he's like the shoot 'em up was going on is like. You see all this radiation going on. You're going like, is that like the end or what? You know. And then I remember seeing another one as a kid called The Girl Hunters, and it was like that was from the 60s. And Mickey Spillane was actually playing Mike Hammer in this movie. Ralph Meeker was in Kiss Me Deadly, and it was like it had what's her face in it from Shirley Eaton, who was the gold girl in Goldfinger. She was like the femme fatale in the movie. But I just remember watching it as a kid on a Sunday afternoon, and it's like, okay, it's a crime movie. It looks pretty good. You know, the girls are hot. And then there's this one scene where Mickey Spillane's fighting the bad guy, and he beats the guy up, but he doesn't want the bad guy. He's got to go somewhere. He doesn't want the bad guy to wake up and escape. So in order to pin him down, he grabs like a spike, and he nails his hand to like the wall or something. I'm like, oh, man, that's pretty rough stuff, you know what I mean? Yeah. So... If anybody out there sees these Spillane movies on the old ones on, there's a couple of other ones on TCM or something like that. Definitely check them out. They're it's wild stuff. It's good stuff, you know.
Well, that's the thing. All the stuff you're talking about, the crime comics, I guess they ended up going to different areas, and that was okay. I think what they were getting upset about was kids could buy comics. From what I understood, everybody read comics. I know kids liked them and got them, but that's the whole thing, was kids were going getting the crime comics, and they were trying to stop it. And there was a lot of things. In Men of Tomorrow, they talked about it. When Wortham, he was looking at delinquents. Where, you know, every time he'd see their areas, you know, he was a psychologist, but he'd see comic books along with cigarettes and everything else. Well, he'd go to these upper class, you know, kids' places. Comic books weren't to be seen. And, but, you know, these were all kids at Ivy League schools, even young kids. And one thing the writer was explaining was it wasn't part of that society.
That wasn't part of that society.
The Ivy League kids wouldn't be going to corner drugstores or, you know, any of that stuff. It was a different world. They weren't exposed to the comics. They would be later, but it wasn't part of the working class neighborhoods. And I always heard this. The first time I ever heard it was Marty Pasco on Word Balloon was talking about Wortham was completely delighted in the 70s or maybe even the late 60s when he started seeing comic fandom, the conventions and the comic clubs and all the people, because he was saying kids that read comics were outsiders, you know, alone, and they would just make them cause trouble. It was unhealthy. But he started seeing people getting together, you know, making projects and, you know, organizing things, and he thought it was wonderful. And he even said he was wrong what he did. But nevertheless, he caused a lot of damage, and to this day, how many people you see refer to comics as funny books, you know, that read something more educational, and yet it's the same people that run out and see all the Marvel movies, you know?
Well, Wortham was like some goofball Freudian psychologist or something. I don't even know. I don't know if Freudian psychology has been like, you know, I don't know if there's Freudian psychology. I don't know if it's been discredited or what, but he was like reading anything anywhere as he could. It was like, I'm trying really hard to find bizarre imagery anywhere I can in this comic book, which almost leads me to believe that maybe he was the one that was more messed up or equally as messed up. But yeah. You know, the thing about Wortham and the fanzines, it was the fanzine, the comic fandom and the fanzines that called him out. Because when he was doing his bit in the 50s, everybody just went along with it. But when the EC fanzines came out in the 60s and 70s, they were all pointing the finger at him. They were going, he's the guy who did it, Wortham. So he was made to be the villain. So I guess he probably felt some sort of like, oh, I don't want to be known as the villain. So maybe he tried to make some peace. And I do know that in some fanzine that I cannot remember what it is right now, somebody who later went on to be a professional talked about how they sought him out, Wortham, and they actually went and visited him and got an interview with him and talked to him about what he did and why he did it and what was the point and does he realize this and that. And I know it's in a fanzine somewhere. Don't ask me. I'm sure if you Google it, Wortham interview and fanzine, you'll probably find it. I can't think of the guy, but it was somebody in the – it was some – in my mind, I think Len Wein, but it wasn't Len Wein. It was somebody from that era that actually sought him out and interviewed him. It's very interesting how he changed, but I think he changed because he didn't want to be known as the bad guy. You know, and around that time anyway – 70, 71, the comics code was dying out anyway. That the Spider-Man drug story was put out without the comics code. Marvel and DC were putting out magazines, you know, yeah. Warren, that had no comic code, and kids could buy them, and there was nudity in them and all violence and all sorts of weird stuff going on. So, you know, by the early 70s, everything kind of took a change completely, you know, but you know, I don't know. I mean, Wortham was just a guy from his time. You know what I mean? He figured out an angle to sell a book, And you know the other thing we don't talk about. He was the guy. Now it's coming into my brain. The more I talk, he was trying to connect juvenile delinquency, which was starting to become a problem in the early 50s with comic books. Now, with the link with crime comics, juvenile delinquency makes sense, but he was trying to make a connection. Like, these comic books are, these kids are reading these comic books and they're becoming juvenile delinquents. I think that, I remember reading something about that. Is that in the book that you've been reading or no?
Yeah, that's a good point. But one thing they're talking about in the book was, I can't stress this enough, the world changed after World War II, the entire world. Anytime you read anything, in the late 80s, I was reading about, I guess it was the drummer for the Grateful Dead, had a project where they were taking these old recordings before World War II. This guy would have a cable, and he'd take these recorders off of a ship. And he'd go, like, you know, Indonesia, Malaysia, and he'd record these old tribal, you know, for, you know, music, where they were, you know, doing religious things, and sometimes even had to hide, because, you know, where they were recording stuff and nobody heard. Well, these recordings sat lame, you know, dormant, and what happened was World War II. The whole world went to war, and they had to stop the project. But after World War II, a lot of those tribes are gone. A lot of the people changed, they got modern. The whole world kind of opened up for everybody. Anyway, this drummer for The Walking Dead was kind of bankrolling the project. And they were putting out on records and CDs in the late 80s. But anytime you talk to somebody from another country, it was almost like hand-to-hand combat, protecting their land and stuff from their neighbors. After World War II, it was bureaucracy. You know, attorneys started coming about, and you could prove from the state office that this is your property. Like I said, the whole world changed on it. And that's one thing with delinquency. All of a sudden, you started having kids growing up without fathers because they lost them in World War II. And that's when teenagers stopped being part of a workforce and they started having leisure time. That's when you started getting all those...
They figured out in the 50s that teenagers were becoming a buying, marketable. You know what I mean?
Well, they had pocket money. It's the whole thing about records, people buying rock and roll and stuff. Well, all of a sudden, there's this generation that started appearing doing that. You never had that too much in the past. You know, everybody's working to support the family. But, you know, society changed everywhere, especially in the United States. So, delinquency, I think, was something new that they didn't really know what to do with. Yeah, it is in the book. I can't stress, this book is really good. I keep referring to this. On the blog we have a reading list. All four members have 10 books that we recommend, you know, comic related, if you'd like to try out. We added another one. It's the books about comics. And I've got The 10-Cent Plague. I've got Men of Tomorrow. Outstanding book. I can't think of some of the other ones, but they're books about comics or comic history. Oh, The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which is a book of fiction, but it ties in with the whole, you know, it's people doing comics in the early days. All the stuff around them are real comic history, even though it's a fictional book. But, I've heard references to these books, and when I started reading them, they are outstanding. So if you want to know more about the history of comics, these are well worth reading. But the 10-Cent Plague...
Who wrote the book? Give the person a plug.
Yeah, I'm saying the name. David Hadju. H-A-J-D-U. Hadju. On the back... It just says, The 10-Cent Plague is about the best account yet of comics in America, an instant classic of culture history. Every once in a while, moral panic, innuendo, and fear bubble up from the depths of our culture to create waves of destructive indignation and accusation. David Hadju's fascinating new book tracks one of the stranger and more significant of these episodes, now forgotten, with exactness, clarity, and serious wit, which is the best kind. He illuminates the lives of his protagonist from pompous on the make-sensers to crack comic book geniuses with his own graphic powers, as well as his intense intellectual curiosity. The book is a rarity, vividly depicting a Norrish 1950s America without a trace of irony or nostalgia. That kind of sums up what the book's about. I've always heard comic history, if you ever read about comics, you'd always go back to these things, but he brings up a lot of stuff that the other books don't, that, like I said, Crime Does Not Pay, I wasn't aware of. You know, this is the last book in the list that I've read. And, I mean, some of it, they always talk about Will Eisner, you know, Jack Kirby, all this stuff, which is true and it's good. But there's a lot of other little things that other things that I wasn't aware of that started popping in that he's giving you a different avenue. So,
hey, let's take a break because I got to plug in my computer because the power's getting low. So we got some new music, right?
You got it. I'll see you on the other side.
Life is like a You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Your Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
I'm putting the phone behind my back like Jim Morrison, my microphone behind my back like Jim Morrison on the Ed Sullivan Show, so he doesn't pick up your voice. I'm doing like the Jim Morrison bit.
That was so awesome when he did that, by the way. That was a great video. All right. Okay, you ready?
Yep.
Yeah, ready.
Okay, that was French Made. That was a metal band from the early 90s in Erie, Pennsylvania. I ended up meeting the guy. I worked with him. I was the bassist and the singer. And when I found out that he played, I said, "Were you in a band?" "Oh, yeah." And he was telling me about it. I said, "Do you guys have any recordings?" Again, everything I do is trying to get music for the show. And I was actually really impressed. They were a lot of songs. They were great. So, anyway.
It's pretty good. It's pretty, you said they opened up for Quiet Riot and Lynch Mob, so they were a contender.
Yeah, they messed them up. This guy, I can't stress, he's understated. He's just a nice guy. No errors or anything. No complaints. He's really good to work with, but every once in a while he'll say something, "I'm not feeling it today." You know, like he's tired or it's hot or something. And I always say, "Oh, don't give me that. You live the dream. You live the dream. You got to be a rock star for how many years?" But every once in a while, you know, I keep pestering him. He'll tell me about it. Yeah, they opened for Quiet Riot. They opened for Lynch Mob. And there were some other people that they played with and met. And I just remember he's telling me about they play in some of these clubs for 4,000 people, which it's just... It's a lot of people when you're actually still a local band, but anyway.
Does he have a blog or something that we can promote the music maybe?
Yeah.
Or is it available online
or
something?
Yeah, the Metal Encyclopedia. He's got it on it. And I'll have that linked on the blog, you know, when this episode comes up. And he was showing me there's videos, and they're posted by people from Italy and Germany. You know, he says, I guess at one point, until he met me, he was trying to just kind of forget all this. You know, he plays it low. And you know me, he brought the CDs in. Some of the people I work with, "Hey, check this out." And I've shown pictures of him. He looks like all the people you saw on MTV. And I said, this is him. And, oh, my God. I mean, he looked great. He looked like he could have been on the cover of Cream magazine or something. Which again,
Cream magazine.
Cream or Hit Parade or any of those old rock magazines.
But, if you ever try to read some of those Cream magazines, they're just like
nasty.
They're written by the articles. Some of them are written by goofballs. Okay,
well,
they're just like
goofball, and it was nasty. They were horrifying to the people. You know, the whole time. You know, when you read this, I remember they're talking about Queen. And it says, okay, so Freddie Mercury can do this, and he can hit this high note. Whoopee, shit. They don't, that's what the... What is this? And it seemed like if they weren't just lambasting all the bands that you loved and bought the magazine to read...
That's exactly right.
Yeah, they were just tearing them to shreds. And it's like...
Guys like Lester Bangs and Richard Meltzer and Robert Krycka, all they did was tear... into all the prog bands and all these bands, and all they liked was like underground stuff, which I liked too. They loved, you know, Lou Reed and Velvet Underground, and you know, a lot of the soul music, which is really great too. But oh my God, some of these reviews, and maybe some of them were deserving, but man, they would just tear into people. And then you listen to these records and you go, these records aren't that bad, dudes.
Oh, no,
you guys were
no.
Just like, you guys just had a chip on your shoulder, or your New York Dolls vibe, which I love the New York Dolls vibe. And, you know, just because you like the New York Dolls, I mean, you can't like, I don't know, Yes or something like that. It's a stretch though. That's a stretch, but I'm just saying.
No, but you can like all those bands.
your taste evolve and you can keep both on in your turntable or in your record collection. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Well, that was the other thing. They would talk about in one article how much they love the Ramones or something.
And yes.
Later on down in the magazine, they'd be tearing the Ramones a new one about how bad they were and you're an idiot if you buy this stuff and why buy into this. I mean, the only thing
Oh my God, the Ramones suck. On this new record, Johnny Ramone actually has a guitar solo. Oh boy.
Yeah. And it was a crummy magazine. It wasn't printed well. It was on newsprint. The photos were all muddy. The only thing nice was the logo with that beer that said, Boy Howdy all the time. That's the only thing I liked about Cream magazine. And I liked whenever they'd have some of the artists like Blondie or something in the editorial pages, they'd have pictures of the bands holding Cream beers.
And Boy Howdy.
Yeah, Boy Howdy. I always liked that. I thought that was cool. While they lambasted them in all the articles, but the bands would still show up. That was my least favorite.
I mean, they would have an occasional review and a few things that were worthy, but most of it was juvenile. But apparently there's a movie or a documentary about Cream magazine. You know, I have a bunch of copies of it. I would buy it sometimes just for the pictures. I was like, oh, cool, because you couldn't see the videos yet. It was still mid-70s. You didn't see the video, so you see Bowie and Roxy Music and Zeppelin. You go, oh, that's a cool picture. You know, wow, man. Or else you would buy it for a record review. It's like, oh, you know what? Let me read this. Oh, this sounds really good. And then you buy it, and sometimes it's good, and sometimes it isn't. You know, it's like, okay. Yeah, I remember Cream magazine really promoted Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah.
Now, I like Blue Oyster Cult. I think they're a worthy band. They're a good band. But then I later find out that one of the reasons they were promoting it, maybe not the main reason, but, you know, you can take it into consideration, was that Richard Meltzer and I think Lenny Kaye, who were writers for Cream magazine, I believe they contributed lyrics to some of the songs. Maybe not Lenny Kaye. Lenny Kaye was involved with the Patti Smith group, but I think Meltzer and some other writers were involved with the Blue Oyster Cult. So you're like, well, you know, whatever. You know, maybe they were buddies. Maybe they're from New York,
yeah,
so
but
New York bands or something. I don't know. I don't want to call it nepotism, but buddies, you know? So, yeah.
At the same time, though, they'd still lambast Blue Oyster Cult. I'd read it in the magazine. And Patti Smith. Sometimes you'd read about it, and she was the second coming to Christ. And other times, you know, why are they listening to this drivel? This woman should be living in a gutter somewhere. I mean, every time I bought Cream, I always wondered why. I said, why am I buying this, you know? But, you know, it'd have an article on the B-52s, which you couldn't find anywhere else. You know, even though I had some of the records, nobody talked about them. So you'd pick it up, and all they do is talk about this as nonsense and garbage. They'd be flipping. It's almost like buying a book about comics, and they're acting like it's the Batman TV show, and they're flipping, wham, pow, you know, it was...
Because they had cool pictures. I mean, the reason I'm dogging them, because I pulled one out the other day, and it had a Gabriel Genesis article. I'm like, oh, man, I should check this out. The pictures are fantastic. And when I read it, all it was some goofball who was probably on some kind of medication just goofing around on Genesis. I go, this is, like, worthless. Okay, this is not telling me anything, doing anything. This is just some guy's stream of consciousness about a prog band or whatever. This, I guess, is before punk, 73 or 74. I'm like, okay, well, this was not good reading, but maybe if you're wasted, it reads really great or whatever. I don't know. But, I mean, Rolling Stone was a better magazine, and maybe Crawdaddy was better. But Cream was definitely, like, the most, you know, famous. Not as famous as Rolling Stone, but it was always there in the newsstand.
Oh, yeah.
You always saw Cream magazine. You always saw it right next to Hit Parader and, you know, whatever the other ones were or whatever. But I do have another story, though. And this is, of course, my obligatory Chilton reference in the podcast, because we didn't play the music, but I'll mention a Chilton story. Big Star, which was the band that Chilton is best known for, I didn't know the Box Tops had a hit and whatever. Their career was basically made by Rock and Roll Journalist, because what happened with that band was that they released an album, their first album, which was a big critical hit, but it got no distribution because of problems with the label. So the band technically broke up. But then one of the guys that was involved with the band, one of the promoters or whatever, had this idea to invite all these journalists, I believe from New York, maybe some from LA, to Memphis to see a reunion of Big Star. So basically, they gave them free tickets. They gave them plane tickets to all come down to see this thing. And all these guys from Cream or whatever came down, and Big Star played, and they fawned over them so much that Big Star actually got to put out another record, which didn't sell anything because of bad distribution problems by the label. So in a way, kind of like they became a cult band because of some of these. You know, that's the thing about these guys. These guys, the journalists, they always loved the up-and-coming cult band that wasn't – they really hated metal. I remember, if I remember correctly, Cream and all of them at the time, mid-70s, hated Led Zeppelin. They hated Deep Purple. They hated Yes because it was overblown, heavy or whatever. They liked more – you know, they were almost – they were sort of preparing for punk rock. They were almost grooming themselves with punk rock or the – The Stones were already like over the hill, and the Dolls were cool, and then the punk guys came along. But they kind of made, you know, Big Star / Chilton into cult, you know, celebrities, heroes or whatever. So, you know, take it for what it is. But, you know, that was our music section of the show, which I know Dallas really loves, and he also loves the video section of our show. But maybe we should talk about comics again. I don't know.
Is Dallas even aware of the video section of the show?
Yeah, doesn't Dallas complain when we do video, when we do movie reviews or something like that?
Well, no, I think he was, I don't know who it was. I think somebody mentioned it, and he just said, I don't think he really cares.
Oh, okay.
I think it's somebody else that, I'm guessing somebody else said, what are you talking about this? And so he...
Oh, it was? Okay.
No.
And you know my answer to that is because we can. And onward and forward.
Yeah, anyway, but the band was French made. They're really good, and you'll hear some more of them. And, I don't know. Living the dream, dude. And
yeah, live that dream again, man.
All the things that said about Cream magazine, if I would have had a chance to write some articles, I would have gone to that magazine in a heartbeat, even though
You got that right. Free records? All those free records, getting to meet, you know, all those, you know, rock stars and, you know, the groupies and, you know, I'll pass on the drugs, you know, the beer I'll take, but, you know, yeah, I would have done it too. But I would have written a more thoughtful and well-written interview, except maybe if the editor of Cream saw it and go, this isn't good for us. We have to turn it into some Gonzo.
Yeah,
it was almost like Gonzo writing. It was almost like they thought they were Hunter S. Thompson or something like that. I don't know.
I'm sure a lot of people liked it. They were, you know, it was a prominent magazine, and I'm sure a lot of people loved that, and they're listening. I said, why are these lame dream Blaine's even talking about this? It was a great magazine. I loved it, you know? So, anyway.
Yeah, whatever. I don't know.
All right.
Anyway, you gotta have a comic book to talk about, I'm sure.
Okay,
you got to.
Here we go. Digging through the comic boxes at Yancey Street with Rook, I found a book that I've always heard about, but wasn't real familiar with. The Human Target.
Oh, I remember that character.
Now, how do you know of him, if you don't mind me asking?
I seem to remember it might have been an issue of Showcase from the 70s or the 60s or something with the Human Target. I never read it, but I remember seeing it. That's what I remember. My memory could be faulty, but that's what I remember.
It was Len Wein. The way I found out, I think it was Fox had a TV show called The Human Target. And somebody I knew on Facebook was talking about it, so I watched it. I watched the first one. It was good. I can't tell you anything about it now. I just remember watching it. This is okay. I never saw the show again. But Len Wein was behind it, and I guess he was working on the TV show itself. I'm going to say this is probably 2008. Anyway, this is a Vertigo book. It's written by Pete Milligan and drawn by Javier Pulido.
Oh, yeah, from She-Hulk. Yeah, he's really good.
Yeah, well, he's turned into a favorite of mine, thanks to Al. It says here the Human Target was created by Lynn Wein and Carmine Infantino.
Okay.
But,
I believe it.
I'm trying to find out when this book came out. 2003.
But, really? Javier Pulido was working in 2003 in comics? Well, he's been around for a while.
But I remember I found the first issue, which I just showed you, and the fourth issue. It was good, but it was confusing. The first issue basically talks about this guy. He goes through, he's all bandaged up. You know, the first thing, he's bandaged up like the Negative Man in Doom Patrol. And it starts off with saying, they say that money can't buy you happiness, and maybe that's true. But there are some things that money can buy, like a new face. And it shows him basically doing surgery, and he's all bandaged up. And then it starts showing these past with this guy, you know, burning people up and all that. And all of a sudden it switches, and he's this older, white-haired man with a young wife. And this is where I got confused. He's starting off talking about surgery, and the next thing you know, he is this man. He's a milquetoast. Somebody's trying to kill him. And I'm thinking, well, what is all this? Well, it turns out he is the Human Target, but he forgot. He was living this man's life, and finally somebody snapped him out of it, and he had to take care of whatever it was. But as much as I enjoyed it, I had to keep reading this like 3 or 4 times. Again, what is this character? And then the fourth one, he's got somebody else's face. I'm going to find the other issues. As confusing as it was, I still enjoyed myself. But I was shocked to find out Javier Pulido had been around a while, even though I never heard of him, thanks to you and She-Hulk.
Yeah, I'm surprised too. The first time I saw his work was She-Hulk.
Yeah.
You know, and that was 2016 or something like that.
Yep. So, I'm going to go down the list. This one is a strange one. Secret Weapons. It's a book by Valiant, which isn't a company that I ever really read their comics from. Go ahead.
All right.
Oh, I thought
who draws it? Javier Pulido.
Yes, no. It's by Eric Heiserer, Rahul Allen, and Patricia Martin. I saw this at Wilson's. This isn't a dollar box fine. I paid the full Monty for it. And they had 3 issues on the stand, and the third cover kind of caught me. And I thought, what is this? And I picked it up, looked through it. The cover art is different than the interior, but I like the interior. It kind of reminds me a little bit of Jeff Darrow, a little bit. But I liked how they drew buildings and signs. I liked how he drew the people. He's a pretty dynamic artist. Different camera angles. All kinds of stuff. They're drawing tight and technically, but they're also drawing things out of their head. You know, creatures, all kinds of bio stuff. So anyway, I thought, well, okay, I'm liking this. So I didn't want to buy all 3 sight unseen new, so I bought the first issue. I said, well, I'll try it out. Took it home and really liked it. It's basically talking about a company that is trying to shut down this area, and I guess the company hid some people. But they're basically raising people with some type of a talent into superheroes. But, you know, they're just wearing black leather and hiding. They're all street kids. And they lost 2 of them. And these 2 kids find each other, and they're sending some other people out to find them. They got other people that, I guess, the experiment didn't go so well, and there were biohazards, and they're, you know, tracking them down. It was neat. And I thought, well, this is great. So I went back to Wilson's to get the other 2. Long gone. I went to Yancey. Long gone. I don't know if Yancey ever had them. So anyway, I read this first one. I like it. It seems like, even though it's the first issue, I don't know if this was based off something else, because they were making references. This thing has a history. It's pretty robust. It's like reading an issue of X-Men, except that you don't have 400 billion different issues of continuity and stuff, but it has a story. It's not thin. The artwork, I can't say enough about it, and I've got this on my phone, you know, the issues I need to get. It was a book that I wasn't aware of that I can't live without now. And the only time I ever bought a Valiant book is if I bought a Magus Robot Fighter or Torok Son of Stone reprints. I never bought any of their newer stuff, but I finally bought a new Valiant book that I want to read.
So did you when you bought this book, you bought it sight unseen? You just looked at it and you said, "I like the art, I'll read it." Well, you have no clue what it was.
No, the third cover I liked. That's what caught me. They had the third cover out on the shelf, so I just picked it up and thumbed through it, because again, the cover caught me. This cover wouldn't have caught me so much.
Oh yeah.
But it was by the same artist. But I opened it up and I liked the artwork inside. It was a different artist. So this is interesting. So I just decided to get the first book, the first issue. But I like it. I like it quite well. It's been a while since I read it. You know, I've had it every time I go to somebody's place to do a show. I have it in the pile, but we just never gotten through it. So, but yeah, Secret Weapons. I like it. I'm gonna
thumbs find up.
It. Huh?
Thumbs up.
Oh, yeah, thumbs up. I guess I'm going to have to go online and buy it through an online seller.
You going to try to get it on Amazon or on digital?
No, I'm going to buy it through.
You get a real copy in your hands. Yeah.
But I've never seen it near the store except for Wilson's. I even dug through all the dollar boxes trying to find those two issues there, thinking maybe they just decided they'll never sell them.
What the heck? I'll just talk about something that I didn't read, because it won't be the first time. I found this in one of the boxes, and I forgot about that. I had these. You remember these things? These Doc Savage little pulp, these big pulps or whatever. Can you see it?
Yeah, I see the logo.
These are cool, man. They have the original illustrations on the inside of the. I forgot who the artist is. I don't know if he's credited on there, but these are really cool. I remember they were these are beautiful illustrations. So I remember they were putting these out years ago, and I was like, oh, I didn't know I had one of these. I must have gotten it cheap somewhere or whatever. But
for the comic books? It's
great stuff, man. I mean, have you ever bought any of these? Did you ever read any of the Doc Savage?
No. Is it a comic book or is it a prose?
No. It's the actual pulp.
Oh.
With the illustrations that came with it or whatever, or even though, there you go. It's like the shadow. It's like the Street and Smith pulps or whatever. Oh, yeah. They put these out like about 10 years ago or something like that, and they're so cool. And they have the covers by James Bauma.
Yeah.
You know, which are always awesome. And the model for the covers is this guy called Steve Holland, who did the modeling for a lot of the, you know, superhero-ish. He did a lot of the Avenger, the Doc Savage, and tons of, like, probably Spillane stuff. Where he was a very memorable-looking face or whatever. And he also was an actor. He was also in a Flash Gordon TV series from the early 50s made in Germany, which you can buy on, which you can find on dollar DVDs or whatever. So, yeah, Steve Holland is in it, but these are so cool. You know, I mean, again, I'm glad I have one example of it. I didn't read it. As a kid, I tried reading a Doc Savage paperback, and I just kind of gave up halfway through. Even though it was good, I was just, I don't know, I wanted something more, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe I picked up the wrong one or whatever. I don't know. But it's great stuff, man. You need to check it. If you're into this stuff, the pulps or whatever, you should check this out. This is really nice. I don't know if I know they have more of these. They weren't cheap, though. They were $12.95. I'm sure I paid a lot less than $12.95 for it. But you remember that Doc Savage movie?
Yeah, with Ron Ely.
Were you a fan of it, or did you not like it?
I understand. I was 13 years old, so yeah, I liked it. I've never seen it again. My two best friends and my brother and one of my best friend's little brothers, we all went to see it together. I had a good time. And I remember when they'd advertise it on TV, they had this little animated snake that could shoot laser beams out of its eye. And I thought, and they kept showing Ron Ely with this hot woman saying, "Mona, you're a brick." And I thought it was going to be, you know, like rated R or something, because all that stuff was rated R. I was, wait, I can go see this. And when I went to the theater, it was a Saturday afternoon, a lot of kids. And it was all over the top. It was like Batman 66, you know, but I liked it. It was kind of fun. And my friends liked it. But when I was in high school, I remember some guys would just bag on it, that they thought it'd be something more. It kind of destroyed the franchise. I guess I remember seeing the Doc Savage paperback books in the bookstore. I'd always pick them up and look at the covers, like that one you were just holding. And if we understand that those paperback books were basically just the pulps that they just reformatted into little ones. The covers always amazed me. I always read the backs, but I never actually bought one. But the show itself, Ron Ely didn't look anything like the Man of Bronze from the paperback. But some people blame that movie for completely destroying the franchise. They said they were popular books that everybody read, and after that nobody would touch them, and Doc Savage went away.
The thing about the Doc Savage movie was it was campy, I remember correctly.
Yes.
And it was kind of Batman campy in a lot of ways. Yeah. And you're talking about, what, 70, middle 70s somewhere.
73.
I guess the middle 70s. In movies, and that makes sense to me now when I think about it, what a darker time. You know, I really don't remember it being that way, but I guess it is in retrospect, because I told you about the most horrendous double feature I ever saw in my life, which was a double feature in the mid-70s of The Exorcist and Deliverance.
Oh.
You know, those are two downer movies, and I'm saying that in the most... you know, lightest way possible. But yeah, I guess when you compare those two movies, were big hits, and then you got happy, old, go lucky, kind of goofy, fun Doc Savage, it pales in comparison. But I watched it on video, and I it was okay. I liked it, and it didn't bother me at all. You know,
I've never seen it again. But one thing I've always talked about, those old superhero shows, anytime it was comic book based or anything like that, it was always flippant. It was always, like you said, campy. It's because of the Batman show. They never took them serious. Anytime you talked about, comic books, and they start talking that way. And that's how it was until the Christopher Reeve Superman. And even though they were lighthearted and stuff, they were treated more like a regular movie. And, but yeah, back then, even that Broadway play, It's a Bird, It's a Plane, you know, about Superman, it was always silly, you know, kind of. That's how they always did it. But the Doc Savage movie, I've never seen it again. I always remember it with great fondness. It came out in the 74, beginning of 75. I was 13 when it came out. I liked it, but I've never seen it on any TV rerun. I've never seen it available on VHS.
I have it on VHS. I'm one of the big clamshell VHSs. Those things are valuable, man. My friend's making a lot of money. I'm going to start putting them out on eBay. Those old clamshells of Elvira and all those B movies, people are paying like 50, 60, 100 bucks for them if they're in good shape. Because I saw a video on YouTube. There's guys out there now that have basements when they live in states where you can have a basement. And they're turning their basements into ersatz video stores. I'm not kidding.
I've seen that. I've seen it online.
There's this one guy that's got his video store. It looks like the horror section in at a Blockbuster, yeah. And it's even got the candy and the magazines.
I've seen some
and everything. Yeah. You know,
yeah,
thing.
I've seen some of that online.
Yeah, that's a thing. You know, but yeah, you know the Shadow. Doc Savage, the movies, The Phantom, they were okay.
Yeah.
They were never a big hit, but they were okay. The Pulp guys, I liked them. Yeah, they're fun. You saw The Phantom, right, with Billy Zane and The Shadow with Baldwin?
Yeah. I really wanted to like those because I liked The Phantom. I liked The Shadow. And I remember when The Shadow movie came out, they made a big deal about it. I remember they had posters, free posters at comic stores. And I rented both of those movies on VHS. And there was parts of The Shadow I liked, how it started, but then it just, I don't know, the movie kind of faded away. But then I found it on DVD when I was visiting my daughter one time, and I was happy to get it, watched it. I liked the movie. I mean, I don't remember it being as good as it was. It was, I thought it started out strong. Originally, I thought it kind of unraveled as it went on. It was good. It had a neat story. It was fun. I've never seen The Phantom again. I remember I thought Billy Zane looked great as The Phantom. But for some reason, VHS, it just didn't do it for me. But I imagine if I could find the movie on DVD, maybe I'd enjoy it more. I know I've talked to people that like the movie quite well. But The Shadow was, it's worth watching. You know, but I hardly ever see it on TV anymore.
Was Penelope Miller, was she a Margot Lane in The Shadow? Was that Penelope Miller?
I couldn't tell you.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah, but the pulp movies generally, I guess maybe because they were, the reference point maybe is lost on some. I don't know. You know? I mean, but the pulps, I know some, well, my Joust loves the pulps, but that's because he loves everything from the 40s, and I'm like, he likes old time radio too, and I like it to a certain extent, but I'm not like a big super duper fan of listening to a lot of old time radio. Would you ever get into it at all? Like the old suspense shows and all that?
Yeah, I sure did. They used to have they actually still do on iTunes. They have iTunes Radio, and there's a lot of channels. I used to listen to that. The only thing was they just kept repeating the same shows sometimes. But somebody told me about, there was a podcast for the old Superman radio show, which I'd always heard references to. So I listened to those for about a year. Superman was a lot different in the radio show. I don't think he was Clark Kent, and he was kind of gritty. But those stories were good. But yeah, I did like old-time radio. It was fun.
Because every time I listened to them, like Joust or whoever, other friend of mine would make me copies of them. They would do some of the horror shows. And those horror shows are really annoying, like Lights Out or whatever, because it was always this really loud keyboard organ music and a lot of screaming and yelling in them. And it's like, oh, after a while, you're like, oh, stop already, you know? I can't take it anymore. But, you know, a lot of those, and here's my comic book link, a lot of those old-time radio stories ended up being rewritten for some of the horror comics and such, you know what I mean? You know, you see some ideas kind of like recycled or whatever, so it's like, yeah, there's a link between the media, you know, between radio comics, books, radio comics, television, movie, blah, 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 you know what I mean?
Yeah. Pop, the thing with old radio shows, I was too young to experience that. My parents would talk about it. My mom loved The Shadow. My dad loved Lone Ranger, all those shows. But I'd hear references, and one thing my dad, whenever some kid would say something, you know, my brother or something, if it wasn't really right, we were trying to coax him into letting us do it, my dad would always say, "Oh, you Fibber McGee." I had no idea what that meant.
Fibber McGee and Molly, yeah.
Yeah, well, I was at 7-Eleven in the 80s. They used to sell cassette tapes at the cash register of old-time radio. And it'd say Philip Fibber McGee and Molly. That must be what Dad's talking about. And I was watching I Love Lucy. You know, Lucy was always, you know, trying to finagle something. And she was denying something. And Fred and Ethel were in there. And I remember Fred said, Lucy said, "Wouldn't you believe me?" or something like that. And Fred goes, "Not unless Molly McGee's husband's turned over a new leaf," and everybody started laughing. I said, Molly McGee, oh, Fibber McGee, that must be him. Some old woman was just talking the other day, and she said something about Fibber McGee. I said, yeah, that's a radio show. She was surprised to know. But then, again, through iTunes, it was the radio, and I'd hear that when they talk about Fibber. I heard one of the shows. Like I said, radio shows, it was always kind of in the pop culture. I always enjoyed, once in a while, somebody try to bring back a radio show on the AM or FM. I'd listen to CBS had a mystery theater.
Yeah, they sure did in the 70s.
Yeah, and we drive between Oklahoma and Texas. We couldn't wait if they played, we were in the car, we'd talk about it. I only heard a handful of them. But yeah, they were great. I do like it, but I don't faithfully download them or try to follow them.
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, anybody out there, but I believe that they actually did in the 70s, maybe, a Fantastic Four radio show, and yeah. Bill Murray was the voice of the Human Torch.
Yeah, you're correct. They did do one.
I am correct. Okay. All right. Which is kind of weird.
I don't think it lasted long. Did it ever even come out?
What's that?
If it was on, I don't think it lasted long. But was it even?
Probably not. I never heard it. I've never even heard repeats. I mean, files of it or anything like that. I just know it from hearsay or whatever. So you confirmed it. So
yeah, I've seen it on Facebook. People have talked about it, and I've heard the Bill Murray link, but I don't know if it was something they were trying to do and it just never got finished, or they did it and it's kind of like the Fantastic Four movie that Corman did, that they did it and it never came out.
Fantastic Four is another one that never really made it big in the movies. It did okay, but it never really hit the way the book hit you back in the 60s,
It's the cartoon show, the Hanna-Barbera show in the 67.
Yeah, the 60s cartoon show was pretty good. I should tell you, I take that back. But Herbie the Robot and all that,
That was from the 70s. That one wasn't the same. But the one from 67, there was 20 episodes, and those were greatness. And
those were.
Alex Toth talked about them in that book, Alex Toth by Design. And he was saying that when Hanna-Barbera said, do the Kirby's Fantastic Four, he was shaking his head like, no, that's never going to work. And they were adamant, and they bought the rights to it, and they had Alex Toth do it. And I guess he kind of groaned and complained. In the book, he was talking about it. He just didn't think how they could translate that into an animated cartoon. And the way he worked is completely different than the way the King worked. And, but he did say that he did it, and he found the cartoon was actually really effective, and he thought it was nice. But the whole time he was working on it, he's like, oh, it's a headache. It's never going to work. But that was something we all remember with great fondness. So
did you hear the story about Toth and Kirby? That when Kirby went to California, Toth found out, and he was like, oh, man, I got to meet this guy. We got to, get together and share secrets or whatever. And I guess they both set up and started drawing, and all Toth got out of it was, I don't understand how this guy does it. He said there was nothing to learn. It was just like, wow. So I think Kirby was an alien. He was from outer space or something like that. He drew kind of without structure lines or anything like that. And the concepts that he came up with were totally out of this world. So Kirby is from another planet. Doubt about it.
You know, it's funny. Rook and I just did an episode. Howard Chaykin is doing a series. I think it's 4 issues, called Hey Kids Comics. It's with Image.
I saw one of them. I saw the first one.
Yeah, I got the first two.
It changes all the names.
Yeah, I was kind of confused because there's 3 characters in it. DC Comics, I guess originally it was National. So in his book, it's Yankee. Instead of Marvel, it's Verve. And some of the characters, like Stan Lee, you can tell it's Stan Lee. But 3 of them, the 3 main characters that they follow, I thought one was Marie Severin, but it's not. And the other, I guess the woman and 2 men that you're kind of following, I think they're fictional. But some of those characters, I think they're based off of people in comics, but he's modified things. But he's got Jack Kirby in there.
Well, he draws Gil Kane in there, doesn't he? He's a guy that looks like Gil Kane.
Yeah, and that's and you can tell that's Gil. But Jack Kirby, I don't know. I think he's kind of changing things around, but Jack Kirby's like some over-the-hill guy that I've had to work with in the past that's kind of bitter and not somebody I'd want to be around. And but I read that, and it says, I wonder if Jack Kirby was really... I mean, people like Jack Kirby. But the way he draws him, I'm thinking, well, I never worked in the comics industry, and every time somebody talk about a deal or something they're trying to do, listen, kid, it's never going to go through. He just kind of moan and complain. Well, that's what Gil Kane, Howard Chaykin said about, you've heard that about Wally Wood, that Wally Wood was just the most unpleasant, whining man he's ever been around, and all he did was complain about how he got screwed all the time. And, but I was reading, it was the book you gave me about Mobius. There was a comics interview or Amazing Heroes or something. An interview with Mobius, and he was talking about that. They brought up about Jack Kirby, and he said Jack Kirby was an absolute genius, and he loved all the stuff he'd done. And when they kept talking about creators' rights and stuff like that, and Mobius talked, he spoke, but he said, well, he didn't really want to answer the question, and the guy kept pushing. And Mobius said, well, I'm going to answer this because you keep insisting. He says, but what I say is going to sound heartless. He said, Jack Kirby should have been, compensated for what he did. He did a lot of things that he was taking advantage of. But Mobius said, but he let it. He knew what the confines were in the working environment, and he went along with it. He didn't do anything about it. And he said, so what I say is going to sound crass and cruel, but he could have gone and worked somewhere else. He could have not done that. He did it because he wanted to. Well, he did it because he was good at it. And the comics.
He had a family.
Well, the comics is the medium he loved. But a lot of those guys went and advertised or did something else. They didn't stay in comics. When they started seeing some of the problems and getting screwed, they went on and did something else. But Jack Kirby stayed with it. He stayed in the confines. John Byrne in Comic Scene magazine when I was in college, he wrote up this whole article talking about one of the quotes in it was, I am a cog in the Marvel machine and I rejoice in it. And he's talking about all these creators that want their own rights, and he's happy to be a cog in their machine. And he was talking about, he agreed to do this, and he's happy to do it, and you don't have to give him any royalties or rights. And he even said, hey, if you want to give me rights for, royalties for Alpha Flight, I'm all for it. But I did Alpha Flight and X-Men knowing full well that the company's going to own them. Okay, good enough. The next issue, Marty Pascal wrote a scathing thing to John Byrne about what he was saying and this and that. But anyway, that came up later when Mobius was doing all the work for Epic. And the people doing the interview was kind of bagging on John Byrne when he said that about, I'm a cog in a Marvel machine and I rejoice in it. And they were kind of talking like the way I would about, that's just asinine. But Mobius said, well, not really. If you're working in the confines and that's what you're happy with and you're doing what you like, it's okay to be in that. It's up to each individual. But in Hey Kids Comics, they basically talk like Jack Kirby. I hate to say this because I love him, and reading his books made my world much bigger. He expanded my imagination. He showed me things that I never would have thought about. But he shows Jack Kirby as kind of a lame complaining duck, maybe some of it, but saying that, Jack Kirby did more than anybody else, and he did it better than anybody else. He completely single-handedly changed the comics industry within all the constraints he was shown.
Oh, you got something to show, huh? Okay.
No, I'm letting the dog out.
Yeah, Kirby and Marvel, Batman too. We don't want to leave out the Batman TV show. They basically turned around comic books. Yeah, the Batman show got everybody into comics, and Marvel just took off after that and, flew to new heights. And then they got Kirby in 1971 when Marvel was too whatever or too cheap to, or whatever you want to use, the word you want to use, to keep them, you know, or not giving in rights or whatever the hell, you know. So
Kirby
never got the rights to the Forever People, did he?
No.
He just got editorial control over them, but he didn't own those characters.
I don't think he left Marvel because of that. What he wanted in Marvel, according to that Marvel Comics The Untold story they kept talking about, he was wanting to be able to write and draw the stories and be credited for it.
Yeah, that was it. But I thought it was over the rights to the ownership of the characters. It wasn't about that? Okay.
Well, there could have been some of that, but like I said, he knew the confines of what you're working in, what he was complaining about, and a lot of people. Wally Wood I understand Wally Wood complained about everything, but Wally Wood was complaining
about Stan Lee,
and about how he's taking it. Seeing this, if you're a writer and you're working with these artists, what would you do? What would you like to do? Well, of course, if the artist wants to do that something, he's going to work really hard on it. If you're just turning in all these scripts, not talking to the artist, and the artist, man, it's going to be hard to draw. You know, I don't know. But if you say, what do you like? What would you like to do? Well, go ahead and do that. You know, and well, that's editing. You know, and then they were putting out this work, and if Stan Lee was going adding dialogue and stuff like that, well, to me, that's editing. He was really good at that. But Jack Kirby was basically plotting and putting the stories together himself. Stan Lee was adding dialogue. They must have talked about things here and there. I've always heard that. So, but Jack Kirby was wanting to be credited for writing and drawing the stories. And I guess the one nail in the coffin, this is somebody he liked, Jim Steranko. When Jim Steranko came to Marvel, he was getting credit for writing and drawing the stories. And that's the one that, I guess, was the nail in the coffin, because Jack Kirby was wanting that same thing, and he couldn't get it. Even though it seemed like he was doing that. But,
I don't know how Steranko got away with that one. Maybe he has a stronger personality or slicker. I don't know. I don't know how he got away with that. Or maybe Stan didn't want to give up the Fantastic Four, you know, all the fame of the FF or whatever. I don't know.
I always hear these things, but, you know, Roy Thomas was talking. We talked about this in the show, you and I, but Roy Thomas is an interview, and he was talking about when they were bringing Stan Lee, Jack Kirby was coming back to Marvel. Stan Lee came to Roy Thomas, who was in charge at the time, and he says, Jack wants to come back. And Roy Thomas is like, well, and Stan wanted him back. Stan was happy. And Roy says, well, sure, he can, but he's not going to be, we can't let him write. And Stan said, well, that's a stipulation. He wants to write the stories too. And Roy Thomas said, well, I guess we could do that and edit. He says, no, that's the other stipulation. He wants to, just like at DC, he wants to edit, write, and draw his stories. And, you know, Roy is like, but I don't know. I guess when he's writing, I guess even if you're doing Marvel style and letting the people come up with everything, I guess you're still kind of plotting things before it. I don't know. To me,
you want to do everything except inking it.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I guess to them, a writer is somebody that kind of controls the story without doing anything. I don't know. I was shocked to read that when Roy Thomas said that. Because Roy Thomas, I know he wrote Marvel style, but I think he also writes full script too, you know. So I don't know, but anyway, Jack Kirby came back and did that. I just heard Tom King on Word Balloon, a John Sandra show. And one thing Tom King brought up was that DC had Neil Adams and Marvel had Jim Steranko. And they were the only two new guys that came in.
Yeah, it's true.
So you talk about this all the time, but they were the only young guys that came in during the Silver Age. They were all old, tired old men from the Golden Age.
Well, you can say that Trimpy may have showed up around that time. Maybe it was a little bit later. Aparo was around in the 60s. You know, I don't know if he's in their ballpark, but I consider him to be like one of the greats. Oh, there was a few, But it was an old boy school, for no doubt about that.
But I guess basically Neil Adams and Jim Steranko became rock stars. You know, I mean, they were considered prominent creators with those companies, even though they were young guys. And then after that, that's when you started getting the Bernie Wrightsons, the Kalutas, the Barry Smiths, you know, all these people coming in. But I never thought of it that way, that Adams and Steranko were the two company guys that came in and, you know, were in that same...
And Jones was, like, peripherally a comic book artist. He did comic book art, but he was mostly painter, illustrator,
yeah,
and some comic book art, you know. And Kaluta, yeah, of course. And Barry Smith was around in the 60s, late 60s, but he wasn't prominent like Neil Adams yet until he got Conan,
yeah,
in 1970 or whatever it was. But, yeah, those were the two guys that DC and Marvel brought in. Actually, Neil Adams says that he is really the only guy, Silver Age guy, that came in of his era. He doesn't consider Jim Steranko to be of his era, which I think he's wrong about that, but...
True.
Hey, whatever. You know, Neil Adams knows it all, I guess.
Well, Neil did a lot more work than Jim Steranko did, I guess.
Yeah, Steranko only did, what, 30, 35 stories maybe or something?
But that's, to me, the power of it was that even though that's all he did, people talk about him like he did a million. You know, he changed...
He did covers, too.
Oh, yeah. He changed a lot. He brought a lot of graphics and stuff in comics that people didn't think about that they do now. And again, in Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, that's my favorite part of the book, was when he came in with his portfolio and Flo Steinberger said, well, they're not seeing anybody. And he says, they'll want to see me. And then she took it back there, and then she came back kind of blown away, goes, he does want to see you. And then when I
You know, he showed up in the late 60s, too, that did something like that. But I think there was already... The door was opening up was, of all people, Tom Sutton. Tom Sutton showed up at Marvel like in 68, maybe, with his portfolio, and Stan started giving him work.
I didn't know that.
You know? And obviously not on the same, he didn't change the comic book landscape, but he's great, too, you know, in his own weird way, you know. But I read an interview with him, and he said he just showed up at Marvel with samples, and Stan said, okay. Here you go. Here's a Western or something that he gave him. So, yeah, I think by the late 60s, the doors were opening. I think those two guys opened the doors for a bunch of people. You know, Don Newton, but Don Newton was more like in the early 80s, I think.
Yeah.
His Charlton guys, you know, Charlton was like in a lot of ways, they opened up the doors for, again, in the 70s, Staten.
I saw Don Newton do stuff in the 70s.
He did do work in the 70s? Okay.
Yeah, I'd seen him around. I mean...
Late 70s, maybe.
I could be wrong, but I thought I saw him in the early 70s.
No, you're right. He did the Phantom for... he did the Phantom for, whatchamacallit, Charlton in the early 70s.
Yeah, because I know I'd seen him. I'd seen his comics, and I saw his name. He wasn't one I liked, but I remember seeing him a lot. Saying that he wasn't one I like, but I've seen some stuff he's done that I like quite well, but most of it I didn't care for too much.
Oh, I love Don Newton. He was great. His Marvel Family books were fantastic.
Yeah.
The ones in the DC Giant Size Super Specials or whatever they were, the Dollar Super Specials, they were great. Yeah, to me that's a guy that doesn't get his due because, you know, he died young. He died in the 80s of some kind of... He drank something about, he was a weightlifter and he would drink unprocessed milk and something happened to him. It poisoned him or it killed him or something like that. It was a weird, weird, weird situation, but he was fantastic. I always liked his work. He did a lot of stuff for Charlton in the early days. Him and Aparo.
I didn't know any of that Charlton. Stuff. I didn't know Don Newton was a weightlifter. I didn't know he was young. I thought he was an older man.
There's a picture online of him and somebody, I don't know if it was Roy Thomas or whatever, but he was in the 70s or the early 80s, Don Newton doing a cosplay of Shazam. And you can see he's a big, muscular guy. You know what I mean? It's kind of cool, actually. And I was like, oh, look at that. You know, my friend actually, Pat, actually, when he was a kid, he bought a Don Newton piece of art at a convention. And then somehow or another, he started wondering whether it was original or not. So he actually got Newton's address, sent him the sketch, and Newton wrote back, "Sorry to tell you, but I didn't draw this. But just because you spent your money, I'm going to send you an original." So he did. He sent him an original along with his forged Newton or whatever. So he's a cool guy, man.
Wow, that is the most awesome thing you ever heard.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Don Newton, I'm sorry I didn't like you, but I do now.
You know, did you ever see that that Avengers annual that he did? That was real nice. I think it was from the early 80s, maybe the late 70s. Did you see that one?
No.
Inked by Joe Rubenstein or somebody like that. It was really good, man.
Hmm.
You need to check it out if you haven't seen it. So, anyway. Well, it looks like on the clock on the wall, it's time to go.
Yeah, well, I was thinking that, but I didn't want to stop. It's getting really interesting at the end.
Well, to be continued.
Yeah, well, we'll do more later. Anyway, anything you want to finish with?
No, I'm done, man. I'm done. We've been over, this is over an hour and change, so, you know.
Yeah.
We could always talk about more stuff, but next time.
Well, another time. Anyway, well, that's all I got. Again, if anybody wants to supply a cover, I'm about to run out of the ones Al gave me, and for the Facebook group. And if that's okay, we can also add it to the blog under comic covers. It's up to you. Anyway, we got a contact page if you need to know where to send it. If you got anything you want to ask or say or tell us we're wrong, it happens all the time, feel free to do that, again, on the contact page or the Facebook page. Anyway, in the meantime,
read
more
comics.
There you go.